Good day. Today is Tuesday, 2nd December 2025. And before I proceed with this video, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched this video or any part of the video that you want to watch, you decide that you've liked what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, let me now turn to the situation, the topics that I'm going to discuss in this programme, and they're going to be dominated by the situation in Ukraine. If I find the time, I'll say briefly at the end of this programme one or two things about Venezuela as well. But let me speak about Ukraine first, and indeed most of this programme overwhelmingly will be about the situation in Ukraine, because briefly, in my opinion, the last 24 hours have been the most catastrophic 24 hours for Ukraine, or at any rate for the Zelensky government, since the start of the special military operation in February 2022. I consider that in their long-term consequence, in their effect, they are actually worse and certainly more dangerous for Ukraine than the first weeks of the special military operation. I understand and appreciate that the Russians were close to Kiev at that time, and that the Russians occupied, or at least were present, in larger territories of Ukraine than they are now. But Ukraine at that time was rapidly mobilising its army. It had the unstinting support of the West. The Russians, far from pressing home their advantage, were indicating that they were prepared to negotiate. As I well remember, Vladimir Putin announced a ceasefire on the second day of the special military operation, though in the event that ceasefire only lasted for a single day. And the Ukrainians were able to get negotiations going in Belarus very soon after the beginning of the special military operation. And as we now know, the focus for the Russians, for President Putin particularly, over the period of that first few weeks, was on the negotiations, not on the war, or on winning a victory in the war. Today, it is completely different. Putin is principally focused on winning the war. The Ukrainian army, which was rapidly mobilizing and increasing in strength in the early weeks of 2022, is now clearly in a process of collapse. And the Russians are advancing and advancing implacably, whilst support from the West, despite all the brave words at the start of the special military operation about as long as it takes and all of that, support from the West is melting away. So these last 24 hours have been catastrophic. Now, let's begin with the military situation. And yesterday, Vladimir Putin again met with his generals. And he met his generals, we're told, in the headquarters of one of the Joint Force Command posts. Now, I've seen the video footage of this meeting. And I'm going to say straight away that it looked to me as if the meeting place, well, it looked to me more like a studio, actually, and it had obviously been set up with props, but it didn't look to me like a real conference centre of an actual command post. And yes, the generals were all there in camouflage uniform, and so was Putin, by the way, which would make sense, of course, if he was in one of the command posts close to the front lines, because in that case, he would need to wear camouflage so as not to make his presence too obvious in case there were Ukrainian snipers or special forces lurking around. But anyway, this time, I have to say, it all looked rather like a prop. The camouflage smock that Putin is wearing, the camouflage smocks the generals were wearing, and the entire setup of the headquarters room where the meeting took place. And you have to go to and watch the video footage yourself to see the extent to which this was so. I am going to venture a guess that the meeting actually took place in Moscow. Put that aside, and it is ultimately irrelevant, because there is no doubt about the substantive truth of what the military officials who were present, who included Gerasimov and the commander of the Russian forces that have been capturing Pokrovsk, and also the commander of the Russian forces who are advancing in Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye region. Anyway, there is no doubt at all that the information they were giving to Putin is objectively true. I say that. I appreciate that the Ukrainian general staff is denying what the Russian generals, who included Gerasimov, by the way, reported to Putin. But video footage has now appeared, which substantively confirms the truth of what these generals told Putin. And briefly, Pokrovsk has fallen. The Russian general, who is in command of the Russian forces in control of Pokrovsk, confirmed to Putin that Pokrovsk, the city of Pokrovsk, is under Russian control. And Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, also told Putin that Pokrovsk is under Russian control. And shortly after these statements that were made at this conference by the generals, in reporting to Putin that Pokrovsk is under Russian control, the Russian Defense Ministry started to release footage of Russian soldiers dispersed right across Pokrovsk, raising flags, raising Russian flags. One of the flags was raised in the central square of the town near the city administration building, but others were raised in the northern areas of the town, including, by the way, in the position, the place where you could say the Pokrovsk gateway is located, the big letters that announce the entry into Pokrovsk, where, if my memory serves me rightly, none other than Vladimir Zelensky briefly had himself filmed just about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Right across Pokrovsk, we saw pictures of Russian soldiers raising Russian flags, confirming that the town of Pokrovsk is now under Russian control. Now, this has to be qualified slightly. The Russian commander of the forces in Pokrovsk did say that there are still some Ukrainian troops in the town, that there's that they're continuing to conduct mopping up operations. But clearly, this does not detract from overall Russian control of the town. The major points of continued resistance by the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk has ended. And at the same time, I don't have any doubt myself that, to all intents and purposes, Pokrovsk passed under overall Russian control some time ago, probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. But as I said, there was still major pockets of resistance, particularly in the Shakhtarsky micro district, the high rise area in the south of Pokrovsk. And the Russians obviously felt that they needed to clear that territory before they could announce the complete capture of Pokrovsk. Now, as it happens, those of you who watched my video yesterday will know that I mentioned over the course of that video that I noticed that the Russian Defense Ministry had omitted all reference to Pokrovsk in its daily update. And I said that I thought that signaled the probability that the Russian Defense Ministry would shortly announce that Pokrovsk had fallen. Well, this was one occasion when I was absolutely right. That is precisely what happened. If you go back to my video, you will no doubt be able to find the place and you will see what I said over the course of it. But anyway, Pokrovsk has fallen. The battle there is over. There are still Ukrainian troops scattered in various places around Pokrovsk, but it is now a certainty that the battle for Pokrovsk has ended. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry, rather the Ukrainian General Staff, still denying this, and Zelensky himself still talks about a complicated situation, but I have no doubt at all that the information that the Russians are providing about the fall of Pokrovsk is true. So anyway, this is the situation in Pokrovsk. Now, the Russian general who was in charge of operations in Pokrovsk, a general called Solodchuk, also provided information about the situation in Mirnograd. He said the destruction of enemy formations in, well, he says Dmitrov, but I will stick to the Ukrainian name, which is Mirnograd, in order to avoid confusion. The destruction of enemy formations in Mirnograd continues. The southern part of the town has been completely liberated and a cleanup operation is underway. The enemy group in northern Mirnograd is firmly blocked. Attempts to exit or unblock this group have been unsuccessful. An estimated 1,500 to 2,000 people are trapped in the northern part of the town. The enemy has made repeated attempts to relieve the siege and also to break out of the city, but as I've already reported, there has been no success. All attacks are being repelled and no breakthrough is allowed. Then the general, General Solodchuk, went on to say, Solodchuk, by the way, suggests that he's of Ukrainian ethnic origin, just saying, but he's a Russian officer. Anyway, General Solodchuk also said that the Russians are attempting to get the Ukrainians to surrender in Mirnograd. I've discussed this at length already. He said that they've received orders from Putin himself to try to secure the surrender of these soldiers. But he said that the Ukrainian high command absolutely opposes this and that they've been able to prevent mass surrenders of these Ukrainian troops by basically giving all kinds of warnings and making threats to the troops. I'm not going to discuss that part of General Solodchuk's report. But anyway, the overall impression given by General Solodchuk is that the battle for Mirnograd is going to end very soon as well. Now, there have been reports from the Ukrainian side, not the Ukrainian military itself, but from various Ukrainian commentators, and they report that the Russians now also control the fields that lie between north of Pokrovsk, stretching all the way to Rodinsk, which would mean, by the way, that the circle that the Russians have drawn around the garrison in Mirnograd is much thicker than some of the maps imply. And, well, there's also been more reports that the Russians have been continuing to advance in the area of their breakthrough the breakthrough that they achieved in August. So they have apparently recaptured a village called Suhitskaya. They're closing in on Belitskaya, and they are not only in control of Vladimirovka and Shahovo, but they're now in control of around a third of the other village in this area, which is Sofeyevka. Kucherivka and Zoloty Kolodias, further to the north, are currently under Ukrainian control. But of course, if all of these other places fall, and if Pokrovsk also falls, then the Russians will be able to recapture these two villages quite quickly as well. So, a collapse in Pokrovsk. I have discussed in many places the significance of the fall of Pokrovsk. It was a major logistical hub for the Ukrainians, supplying the Ukrainian garrisons in Kramatorsk and Konstantinovka and Slavyansk. That supply route obviously has been lost. The Ukrainians now receive all of their supplies from the north through Izium, and I believe there is a road that goes to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the west. But with the fall of Pokrovsk, that road is now also potentially threatened as well, and I suspect that supply line will be cut soon. So the fall of Pokrovsk opens the way for the Russians, if they choose, and I've no doubt they will choose, to begin an encirclement operation of the remaining fortified towns in Donbass from the south and west. There is also the option for the Russians, if they choose, and I have no doubt that they will choose, and they have the forces, the necessary forces to do it. They can also advance westwards along the main road to Pavlograd and beyond Pavlograd to the Dnieper River in the Dnipropetrovsk region and to the city of Dnipro. And General Solodchuk also discussed the situation in the Novopavlivka area. This is the one important town, village, which the Ukrainians have fortified and which would lie in the way of a further advance westwards. He said, "We are continuing to develop the offensive on the left bank of the Novopavlivka area, which is the enemy's main defense node in this direction. We are enveloping the enemy from the southwest, west, northwest, and east of Novopavlivka with the goal of encircling them." Now, I said in my program yesterday that there's been a change over the last few months in Russian strategy. Instead of focusing their operations on actually capturing these places by first surrounding them and then leaving exit corridors for the Ukrainians to retreat through, now the Russians are working to create cauldrons. And we see that General Solodchuk is talking about creating a cauldron for any remaining Ukrainian troops who are still in Novopavlivka. Now, Rydovka, I ought to say, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, actually claimed about 3 or 4 days ago that most of Novopavlivka had been abandoned by the Ukrainians. We see that General Solodchuk is contradicting this. This is one instance, just to say, when Rydovka obviously got it wrong. Anyway, that's the situation in Pokrovsk. Now, the other general who was present, General Ivanayev, discussed the situation in Zaporozhye region. He confirmed the very rapid pace of the Russian advance, and he said that the Russians are indeed now fighting in Guliapolye. He indicated that the Russians had only actually broken into Guliapolye on the previous day. Other reports have claimed that the Russians were inside Gulyapolye some days earlier, but General Ivanayev said that they had only just entered it. He said that units of the 29th and 36th Armies are currently expanding the zone of control on the eastern bank of the Gaychur River. This is to the north, actually, of Gulyapolye. Furthermore, units of the 5th Army entered Gulyapolye yesterday, entrenched themselves on its outskirts, and are conducting street fighting to destroy Ukrainian troops within the town. The offensive in this direction continues. The destruction of enemy formations in the Zaporozhye area is being carried out in accordance with the plan approved by the General Staff of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation. All tasks facing the troops will be accomplished. And Ivanayev, in answer to a question, also said that the key will be the defeat of the enemy, he means the Ukrainians, on the left bank of the Gaychur River, in order to continue the offensive in the western direction within the borders of Dniepropetrovsk and Zaporozhye regions. I think in this case, the left bank means the west bank. And he goes on to say, as well as the capture of Gulyapolye defensive region with its centre in the city of Gulyapolye. So the Russians obviously plan to capture Gulyapolye, but General Ivanayev made it clear that the Russians intend to continue their advance westwards towards Orekhov, which is now at risk of being encircled, and beyond that also to the river, to the Dnieper, and to the city of Zaporozhye. So one gets the sense of an accelerating advance with little sign that the Ukrainian army is now capable of holding back the Russians in any particular place. Now, there was a very interesting discussion between Putin and some of the generals about the state of the Ukrainian army. And General Solochuk, the commander of the Ukrainian forces, of the Russian forces, sorry, in Pokrovsk, said that the various counterattacks that the Ukrainians have been conducting around Pokrovsk to break the siege there are conducted by newly mobilized Ukrainian troops, newly conscripted Ukrainian troops. This is what he said. The nationalist battalions aren't participating. They are refusing this mission. In other words, the really tough brigades, Azov, the two Azov brigades, Idar, all of those, they are refusing to take part in the fighting in places like Pokrovsk. And Solochuk said newly conscripted soldiers are carrying out their duties. These are Ukrainians. It's clear these men were recently conscripted and they're untrained and they're simply marching towards their death in the direction of Pokrovsk. And then he spoke about the fact that the Russians have fill of this area littered with Ukrainian corpses. Well, I am not there. I haven't seen this film that he's talking about. I haven't seen the fields littered with Ukrainian corpses. And it may be that there is a degree of exaggeration here, but I suspect not much. And then Putin used some very interesting language, and I suspect this is this part of the discussion about conscripted soldiers being herded to the slaughter by the callous Ukrainian command. I suspect that this was pre-rehearsed, my guess, and it enabled Putin, it provided Putin with this, with the opportunity to make this statement in reply. This is a tragedy for the Ukrainian people, which is connected to the criminal policies of the thieving junta that seized power in Kiev. Now, these are very important and very interesting words, and I will probably touch on them again later in this program when I discuss Steve Witkoff's journey to Moscow, which is taking place today. But suffice to say this, after the Maidan seizure of power in February 2014, for a number of weeks, the Russians referred to the authorities, the Maidan authorities that had gained control in Kiev and of Ukraine, as a junta. They did not recognize them as the legitimate government of Ukraine. And then there were elections in Ukraine, elections to the parliament, and presidential elections, which were won by President Poroshenko, the man who became President Poroshenko, Petro Poroshenko. And at that time, there were negotiations between Russia and the European powers, Germany and France, in those days led by Merkel and the French president of that time, François Hollande. And Putin also had a number of meetings with the newly elected Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko. In fact, as I remember at that time, Putin and Poroshenko even spoke on the phone. And I can remember that the Kremlin suddenly changed its form of referring to the Ukrainian leadership. So suddenly Poroshenko became President Poroshenko. And the Kremlin, Putin himself, stopped referring to the Ukrainian government, the post-Maidan government, as a junta. And I remember that many people in Russia were unhappy about this and were dismayed because they felt that the elections that had been conducted in Ukraine in the spring of 2014 were illegitimate, but I'm not going to go back to all of that. The point was Putin and the Russian government effectively accepted their legitimacy. Putin has now gone back to the language of early 2014, of the period from roughly February until, if memory serves me rightly, February to April 2014, when Poroshenko was elected president of Ukraine. So he is again referring to the government of Ukraine as a junta, casting doubt, well, obviously not just casting down, rejecting its legitimacy. And he's calling it a thieving junta as well. Now, bear in mind that the last time Putin spoke to the generals, he referred to the government in Kiev as an organized criminal group. Now, to my mind, this makes Putin's stance and the Russian government's stance, the Kremlin's stance, absolutely crystal clear. There is no legitimacy in Kiev anymore. Zelensky is not legitimate. He's not the constitutionally elected president of Ukraine. Putin has said that, made that very point several times. But I have to say, use of this word junta, which is a throwback to Russian language from early 2014, suggests to me that he has again reverted to the view that the entire post-Maidan government of Ukraine, the entire Maidan regime, if you prefer, is unlawful and illegitimate and must be changed. It's the clearest hint from Putin up to now that his objective and Russia's objective is regime change. Anyway, interesting words from Putin. And as I said, all made on the eve of Witkoff's visit to Moscow. Now, Gerasimov also spoke about situations on other parts of the battlefronts. He said that the town of Volchansk in Kharkiv region has now been captured in its entirety by the Russians. And many people are saying that the Battle of Pokrovsk has been very prolonged, and many people are saying that the Russians have been trying to capture Pokrovsk for more than a year or a year and a half. As I have pointed out many times, the Battle of Pokrovsk began seriously in August of this year. So, in fact, the fall of Pokrovsk has been relatively fast. And, of course, the fall of the Pokrovsk conurbation, which has not yet ended, because there are still Ukrainian troops holding out in Mirnograd. Well, when that happens, that will be relatively fast as well. Well, the Battle of Volchansk, by contrast, has been extremely prolonged. The Russians broke into Kharkiv region in May 2024. The Battle of Volchansk began a short time later, and Volchansk has only fallen now. So the battle for Volchansk has taken, well, almost a year and a half. Not quite as long as the battle to capture Marinka, a small town close to Donetsk, which it took the Russians again, well, a year and a half to capture, but almost. And the explanation has been, the explanation for that is that group of forces north, the military force that the Russians have in Kharkiv region, is very thinly spread. It was the force that had to repel the Ukrainian advance into Kursk region. Of course, the Kursk offensive was completely defeated in March of this year, and Kursk has passed completely back under Russian control. Though I noticed that the Western media never mentions that any longer. And, well, the group of forces north is also fighting in all sorts of other places in Kharkiv region as well. So there have never been enough troops to capture Volchansk quickly. But Volchansk is now captured, and that probably works, ties in with Russian plans. Kupiansk has been captured as well. And the Russians, no doubt, will be in a position now to advance south of Volchansk, link up with their forces advancing north from Kupiansk and from other areas on the Russian-Ukrainian border. And, well, if the war continues, we could very well start to see a situation where Kharkiv itself again finds itself under siege. Anyway, that's the situation in Volchansk. And Gerasimov also provided information about fighting in other places. He said that there is fighting going on in Siversk. He says that the Russians are capturing 100 buildings in Siversk a day. Given that we're talking about a relatively small place, I can't imagine that Siversk is going to remain under Russian control for very long. He said that the Russians have broken into and are fighting inside Liman. Again, this has been, I think, fairly well known, but fighting is taking place in Liman too. Very interestingly, he said that the Russians now control around 30% of Konstantinivka. And I understand that video footage has been produced by the Ukrainians, interestingly, which shows the Russians now in central Konstantinivka, well to the north inside Konstantinivka, are where they were presumed to be. So it looks as if the Russian advance in Konstantinovka is indeed developing rapidly. And as I pointed out in my program yesterday, it looks as if the Russians are preparing to, are intending to cut the supply lines to Konstantinovka from the north, from the Ukrainian-held towns of Kramatorsk and Druzhivka. So it is indeed possible, even likely, that Konstantinovka will either be encircled or fall under Russian control quite quickly. And Gerasimov also had some very interesting things to say about the situation of the Ukrainian troops in the east, in the areas in east of Kupiansk. And he said that he spoke at some length about the situation in Kupiansk. He said that the command, this is Gerasimov, the command of the Ukrainian armed forces continues unsuccessful attempts to unblock its encircled groups in the Kupiansk direction, and seeks to stop our advance today. And then he then gave a description of the fighting. He said that on the left bank of the Stary Oskol River, the Russians continue to fight the encircled group following the capture of Kupiansk and continue to tighten the encirclement to eliminate this trap group. Its current strength is approximately 15 battalions, which, if they were up to strength, would be significantly more, by the way, than the encircled troops in Mirnograd. But almost certainly these troops, these battalions, are not up to strength, even assuming, of course, that Gerasimov is right and there's 15 battalions of them there. And then Putin asked him, last time you said, and I asked the question then, can't the enemy retreat along the left bank of the Oskol River to the south? In other words, can't they cross the Oskol River and advance southwards and escape this encirclement? And Gerasimov replied, no, they can't, because south of this encircled enemy group, the 1st Tank Army has a dense defence along the entire left bank. This defence is built up for about 17 kilometres to the south. So the Ukrainian troops in Kupiansk are completely trapped. So that is what Gerasimov said. I'm going to finish this summary of this meeting that took place between Putin and his generals by saying that it gave me a further sense of the personalities of these men who are now commanding the Russian forces. I've seen Gerasimov now several times, and I have to say he comes across as having a very professorial personality. He's often been described as an intellectual soldier, and he certainly gives that impression when you listen to him. There have been various hints or claims at various times about tensions between Putin and Gerasimov. I got no hint of any of that from these various meetings between Gerasimov and Putin. I noticed that Putin always addresses Gerasimov as Valery Vasilievich, in other words, my first name and patronymic, which in Russian, as a Russian term of address, is both respectful but also friendly. I mean, it's not as formal as, say, referring to him as General Gerasimov or Mr. Gerasimov would be. And I get the sense of actually there being warmth and good relations between these two men. Now, as with the other Russian generals, they are an interesting mixture of people, as one might expect. One or two of them, General Solodchuk, for example, give the impression of being rather tough characters, just to say. Others, General Ivanayev being an example, also come across as, if I have to say, rather professorial. Ivanayev reminded me of some CEOs of rather big companies that I have encountered in the past. Anyway, the overall impression is of Russian generals is very different from American generals, at least as I've seen them on television programs and places like that. And there doesn't seem to be any of the sort of bragging and boastful language that I should say American officers of general rank seem to engage in from time to time. Anyway, that's my summary of the military situation. It is catastrophic for Ukraine. The Ukrainians, unable to hold back the Russians, they've lost two important places, Volchansk and Pokrovsk. Mirnograd is about to fall. Siversk is about to fall. Konstantinovka is close to being surrounded and is a third lost. And again, I have no reason to doubt any of this, which is confirmed, as I said, by video footage. The general in command of the forces that are besieging Novopavlovka says that this place is about to be surrounded as well. And the general in command of the Russian forces in Zaporozhye region says that, yes, the Russians do intend to capture Gulyapolye. And he would not be saying that if he was not confident that Gulyapolye would be captured soon, and that the Russians intend to advance, to continue their advance westwards. And to reiterate again, on the eve of a meeting with Witkoff, Putin has referred to the Ukrainian government as a thieving junta, returning to the language, the rhetoric, the Russian rhetoric of February, March, April 2022, and making it absolutely clear that the Russians do not recognize the legitimacy of the political structures in Kiev today. So the military side for the Ukrainians is catastrophic. But the bad news keeps coming and continues to get worse, because if the situation on the battlefronts is disastrous and what we've just been told is by the generals and Putin is a disastrous picture, everything else is going badly as well. Firstly, the Ukrainians are under severe economic pressure. There's a long article on Sona 21 by Larry Johnson discussing the state of the Ukrainian economy. I've touched on this myself. The Ukrainian economy is on the brink of collapse. Go to Sona 21 and you read Larry Johnson's very well researched and thoughtful article on the matter. The Ukrainian budget is in crisis. Ukraine is spending twice as much money as it is raising in taxes. And money from the West is dwindling. The German commentator and economist Wolfgang Munchau said that back in the summer, Ukraine was receiving 4 billion euros a month from Europe, from various European states. That has now fallen to about 1 billion euros a month. I'm not sure where Wolfgang Munchau gets his numbers from. And my own understanding is that the money that they're getting from the Europeans is higher than this. But they urgently need more, given the catastrophic realities in the economy, the collapse of the economy, the collapse in tax collection. And the exploding costs of the wall, and by the way, of the corruption that comes with it, about which more shortly. However, the only plan that the Europeans apparently have to fund Ukraine, and it has to be the Europeans because the Americans are not providing funding to the extent that they previously were, and there are reports circulating today, by the way, though I've not been able to confirm them, and they seem to be mostly rumours, that Donald Trump has stopped all further financial aid to Ukraine, citing the ongoing corruption scandal in Kiev. I have to say, I thought that financial assistance to Ukraine had already stopped from the United States. So who knows exactly what is going on that front. But anyway, the point is that the only major infusion of aid from the West that the Ukrainians were expecting and hoping to receive was the 140 billion euro loan that the European Commission and Friedrich Merz's government have been trying to get the European states to agree to, a loan which would depend on using Russian assets, frozen assets, held by the Euroclear depository in Belgium as collateral. Now, the Euroclear itself has made it absolutely clear that it strongly opposes this measure. It regards it as illegal misappropriation of funds, Russian funds, held by Euroclear. Valéry Urbain, the CEO of Euroclear, has spoken about this trenchantly and has said that if such a thing were ever done, Euroclear would face legal action. And given what she said, it's very, very difficult to see how Euroclear could successfully defend it. And her concerns have been echoed by the Prime Minister of Belgium, Bart De Wever. He's written a letter to Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, in which he said that the proposal to float a loan, a 140 billion euro loan for Ukraine, using the Russian assets as collateral, is fundamentally wrong. He says that this could collapse Euroclear, that the only way that this could be done is if Belgium, which has overall responsibility for preserving, protecting Euroclear and protecting its stability, if Belgium were provided by all of the other European states with undertakings that they would pay, each of them, on demand, the full amount of the Russian assets held by Euroclear, 183 billion euros, and that this promise to pay that amount would be irrevocable. And De Wever also said that this must be a joint and several guarantee, each and every European state giving this guarantee would have to, if asked, come up with the full 183 billion and then try to recover its share of the liability by going to the others. It's clear that he expects Germany ultimately to backstop this loan, because only Germany realistically would be in a position to come up with 183 billion euros on demand in that way. Now, the reports say this morning that the European states have rejected this demand from De Wever. They say that it is extreme and excessive, and that's absolutely correct, and that there is no way that they would ever agree to provide Belgium with this kind of guarantee. According to the Financial Times, one official of one of the European governments said that it is impossible for European states to put at risk their entire financial liability, their financial stability, to risk their financial stability on a potential court decision. This is, of course, absolutely true. This is absolutely correct. But, of course, it implies that they all know that there is a good chance that if there was a court decision, it would go against them. It goes against the entire conception of this plan, which is that it is supposed to be a fail-safe way of providing this loan, because the actual assets, the Russian assets themselves, would be untouched. When the European official says that European states cannot take on liabilities of this kind, based on the risk of a negative court decision, it shows that there is indeed a risk of a negative court decision. And they want Belgium, and Belgium alone, presumably, to take on the entire risk. An absurd position altogether. But what really ought to have killed this proposal, finally, and once and for all, is that the European Central Bank has made known today that it supports the position of Belgium and of Euroclear. It has said that it is not prepared to act as a backstop for Euroclear, that it too clearly regards this project as illegal. If it acted in that kind of way, because this would be something European governments would be forcing upon Euroclear, the European Central Bank would in fact be acting as a backstop, not for Euroclear, but for European governments. And that is not something it can do in accordance with its charter. Now, the last, by the way, is nonsense. The European Central Bank has been helping many European states with their debt problems. I'm not going to discuss this in any detail. But the point is that the European Central Bank, which understands fully the disastrous implications on the credibility of European financial institutions and of wider financial stability in Europe, which would come with this appalling plan. Anyway, they're not prepared to take on the risks of endorsing it. Now, in any sane world, this ought to be the final end of the European 150 billion euro loan provision to Ukraine. In fact, Ursula still seems determined to propose this plan to the European Council at a meeting tomorrow. But I would have thought that in light of the opposition from the European Central Bank, this idea must now be dead. I cannot imagine that European governments in their totality would now agree to a plan like this. Maybe Merz would. He seems to me obsessed enough. But I cannot imagine many of the others agreeing to do this either. Baltic governments, the Swedes, no doubt, would do it. But I can't imagine that the others would. And Belgium, presumably, if they have any belief in what they're saying, and they must do, would presumably vote against it and veto the whole plan if it were proposed, when it is proposed tomorrow. Which, of course, brings us back to Ukraine, because if that is correct, they're not going to get the 140 billion euro loan. And they're not going to get money in anything like the same quantities, because European governments, as Wolfgang Munchau has been saying, are running out of money and are becoming increasingly reluctant to give money to Ukraine. So there are proposals for a smaller loan to be provided to Ukraine, but this is a dribble of money to, by the way, as my colleague and friend Alex Cristoforo has previously pointed out, a country whose massive corruption has now been clearly exposed. So how that makes sense, I can't for the life of me even begin to see. But anyway, put all that aside. It's not going to be enough to keep Ukraine going for anything more than a few weeks. If you give a couple of billion here to this particular massively expensive project, then within a few weeks, the Ukrainians are going to come back and ask for more. And given the speed of the economy's collapse and given the speed of the military collapse, the demands are going to not just continue, but they are going to increase and multiply. So, Ukraine looking at a major financial crisis. But there is also news, difficult news, maybe not for Ukraine exactly, but for Zelensky himself, because he knows that Witkoff is on his way to Moscow. But it seems that the political crisis in Kiev is deepening. And we've had more news coming from Kiev about what led to Yermak's resignation. And there are reports now that Yermak was forced to resign and Zelensky was forced to agree to his resignation because practically the entire governmental structure in Kiev basically rebelled and demanded that Yermak must go. It doesn't seem as if it was really corruption exactly that brought Yermak down or even the investigations. Rather, it was the sense that he had so far overstepped his limits that he no longer had any allies within the entire governmental structure there. By the way, this information reinforces my own belief that the anti-corruption investigations in Kiev conducted by NABU and SAPO are driven primarily by internal players, and it looks as if some of them are in the government. And there are reports that Yermak, becoming increasingly desperate and increasingly angry about the threats to his job, actually tried to get the head of the SBU, Ukraine's most important counterintelligence agency, sacked because the SBU was not carrying out his wishes to, in effect, close down these investigations. So, Yermak was brought down by what was, in effect, an internal coup from inside the Ukrainian government. There have been commentaries appearing, including on the Russian side of the internet, comparing the coup against Yermak to the decision in October 1964 of the Soviet Politburo to remove the Soviet leader, the then Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, from his post. So there you go. Now, obviously, that tells us not just that Yermak's control of the Ukrainian government has basically collapsed, but that so has Zelensky's. Because Zelensky relied on Yermak to keep control of the levers of power in Kiev, but those levers of power escaped Yermak's hands, and they have clearly escaped Zelensky's hands too. It looks as if more and more officials in Kiev are starting to make their own decisions, and that there has been a general loss, a crisis of confidence on their part as to the leadership being provided by Zelensky and Yermak himself. Now, what that says, in turn, is that Zelensky himself no longer has full control in Kiev, and potentially what was done to Yermak can at any point be done by the same people to him. Now, Zelensky himself is currently doing that which he always does when everything seems to be falling apart around him. Whenever he is under pressure, he leaves Kiev. He usually goes to meet his friends in Europe. I discussed in my program yesterday his trip to France. He's meeting there with Emmanuel Macron. And as I said, it was all kisses and friendship and all of that kind of thing. Though not, I noticed, any very important assurances from France, from Macron, of financial aid. Though Macron did continue to say that the so-called coalition of the willing has come up with all kinds of ideas about the kind of security guarantees that Ukraine should receive as a result of any peace and, well, all that kind of thing. So politically, the support to Zelensky from Macron was still there. And Zelensky has gone on to Ireland, and he's been able to get the Irish government to give him around 100 million euros or so, I understand. This after the Swedish government also gave him another 114 million euros. This is all money for Ukraine, I should stress, not for Zelensky himself, though, well, perhaps you never know. But anyway, the point is that, of course, this is small change relative to Ukraine's needs. 200 million euros here or there is nothing when you want 140 billion euros and when you want that money now. But anyway, Zelensky is in Ireland, or at least is going to Ireland. I believe he is actually in Ireland now. And, well, another important person is coming to Ireland, and that is none other than Steve Witkoff. And Steve Witkoff is stopping in Ireland before he flies on to Moscow. And the big question is this: did Zelensky go to Ireland because he wanted assurance from the Irish of their support and this money? Or did he go because he was called there, because Witkoff demanded that he come, or at least the Americans demanded that he come? Now, in my program yesterday, I discussed the meeting that took place between the Ukrainian officials and the American officials in Florida, in which, of course, Witkoff participated. And I pointed out that the meeting was a failure, that the Ukrainians refused to give any ground on any of the substantive issues. They refused any suggestion of Ukrainian pullback from Donbass or any territorial concessions to Russia or any changes to their constitution or any abandonment by Ukraine of its quest for NATO membership or any one of these things. And I've seen more pictures, by the way, from the meeting, and both the Ukrainian delegates and the Americans look depressed and tired at the end of the meeting. There's no sign of smiles or confident looks or friendship or any of that kind of thing. It reinforces my sense that the meeting went badly wrong. And this on the brink of Witkoff's visit to Moscow. Now, I said in my program yesterday that that left Witkoff and Kushner on their way to Moscow, going to Moscow empty-handed. And I wonder whether the decision to summon Zelensky to Ireland is to either get him to agree finally to make the kind of concessions that the Americans need to have if they're going to get the Russians to take them seriously, or if Zelensky is unwilling to make those concessions, whether the purpose, the intention is to tell Zelensky, well, look, Volodya, you've been president of Ukraine for many years now, several years now. You're a hero. You're the new Winston Churchill. Your courage attracts admiration from anybody. You're obviously tired. You're obviously losing touch with things. Maybe it's time for you to retire and to let someone else, someone better able to handle these complicated situations that we have now, take your place. Well, I say that. Zelensky, by the way, does continue to give every sign of being completely out of touch. He made statements yesterday saying that the situation in Pokrovsk is complicated, but that the Ukrainians have won some great victory in Kupiansk. Kupiansk, which of course the Russians say is fully under their control, and of which the Russians some days ago, about a week ago, provided footage showing their soldiers all over Kupiansk raising flags, as I remember. Zelensky, according to him, Kupiansk is under the control of Ukraine. The Russians have been defeated there. And yes, the situation in Pokrovsk is complicated, but still under control. I would say that there are other Ukrainian officials who also speak in this astonishing way. I was reading yesterday a claim by one Ukrainian official which said that the Ukrainians are in complete control of Pokrovsk. They're now in the process of mopping up a few Russian soldiers who are still in Pokrovsk, but all claims that the Russians have control of Pokrovsk are untrue. So, you know, you do see that. It does make one wonder, given the video footage that has appeared today showing Russian soldiers all over Pokrovsk raising their flags, what connection to reality these people actually have and how much of a grip on reality Zelensky himself still has. Anyway, I will make a prediction. If Witkoff and Kushner do suggest to Zelensky that it might be time for him to go, he will at least initially resist it. And, well, the pressure might increase. There are rumours apparently in Kiev that he could go in 2 weeks' time or 1 week's time. But to be very clear, if he does go, he would go unwillingly and it would in effect be a coup, just as the removal of Yermak was a coup also. And at a time when almost certainly, given the fraught atmosphere in Ukraine and given the extent to which Kiev politics are a snake pit today, there would be undoubtedly intensified investigations both of Yermak and Zelensky. Incidentally, there are reports that the Ukrainian security forces have been instructed, and one would love to know by whom, have been instructed not to allow Yermak to leave the country, not to allow him to leave Ukraine. He, of course, is saying that he's going to go to the battlefront. Nobody knows which part of the battlefront, but it's been suggested in Ukraine that he has no real intention of going to fight on the battlefronts, but that he's going to go to some military unit whose commanders are sympathetic to him and basically try to hide out there. Anyway, I'm not going to speculate about all of this because I don't know enough about the facts to be able to speak authoritatively about this at all. But all I would say is that those rumours exist. Well, anyway, I suspect Zelensky will resist attempts to go. And of course, there's still the question of who, if he did go, would take his place. Now, there are rumours that General Zaluzhny, Ukraine's ambassador to Britain and the former military chief, that he's come back to Ukraine and is currently in Kiev. I see no proof or confirmation of this as of the time of this programme. But if that is indeed true, well, bear in mind, an article appeared under his name in the Daily Telegraph 2 days ago. I don't believe he wrote it, by the way, but anyway, that's another story. It was clearly signalling that he's perhaps the right man to rescue Ukraine at this time. I don't believe he is that either, just to say. But anyway, he is supposedly in Kiev, and it may be that he is taking soundings there. All of this might be the signs, might stack up and amount to signs that some kind of coup operation is underway in Kiev. To be very clear, replacing Zelensky with Zaluzhny would not be the kind of regime change that Putin and the Russians appear to be thinking about. It would be more an attempt, I suspect, to stabilize the situation in Kiev and give some political space for Witkoff and Kushner to achieve something with the Russians. But, well, it would mean the departure of Zelensky from the scene. Now, I've already discussed this in many places, and I'm not going to discuss this in any further detail today. All I would say is that a coup in Kiev, removing Zelensky, far from stabilizing the situation, runs a strong risk of accelerating an internal collapse, that Zelensky is accepted across Ukraine as the country's president. He was, after all, elected. Putin may cast doubt on the validity of his position as president of Ukraine, but there doesn't seem to be much question about that in Ukraine itself. Whereas anybody who takes over from Zelensky in Zelensky's place, be it Zaluzhny or the Speaker of the Parliament or anyone else, will invite the inevitable question, who elected you? And given the difficulties of holding elections in Ukraine at this time and the unpredictable outcome of those elections, I could very easily see how this could lead to an even worse political crisis, accelerating what is increasingly looking now as an inevitable collapse. These sort of things are never easy to carry out. Again, perhaps The big warning is the overthrow of President Diem in South Vietnam in 1963. That was intended to stabilize South Vietnam, given that President Diem was also seen in the United States as an unstable and eccentric leader, and was also seen in that way by many people in South Vietnam too, as well. I think students of the Vietnam War now mostly acknowledge that President Diem's fall, the coup against him, which by the way led to his death, destabilized South Vietnam so that it never really regained its balance after his fall. And I can very easily see how the same thing could happen in Ukraine too. Anyway, that then brings us to Witkoff and Kushner, because of course they may be stopping off in Ireland to meet Zelensky, but they're going to be flying on to Moscow. And there they're going to meet Putin, fresh from his meeting with the generals. Putin brimming with confidence. His armies are advancing. His economy, by the way, is stable, just to say. He's about to visit his good friend, Prime Minister Modi of India. There are major economic packages underway. His foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is meeting today with the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, who is also in Moscow. Highly likely that Putin is also going to meet Wang Yi. So this very strong, very confident Putin is due to meet Kushner and Witkoff fairly soon. Now, I am not going to discuss in this programme the multitude of American plans that have been floating around. The Russians have made it clear that they don't consider them as plans at all. They consider them as points for discussion. And they insist that a proper negotiation must take place to work through all of these points one by one to arrive at an agreement on them. And the best that Kushner and Witkoff will be able to come up with after their meeting with Putin will be an agreement by the Russians to negotiate on these plans and Russian proposals to set up a negotiation with proper negotiating parties and perhaps some agreement on a venue. Budapest is certainly a possibility, but Turkey also is. Anyway, Putin, as I said, will be meeting with Witkoff and Kushner. And as far as I can see, he continues to be in an implacable mood. Now, we've had comments from Peskov, who is Putin's spokesman and who therefore expresses Putin's views. Peskov gave a press conference to the Indian media this morning in advance of Putin's trip to Delhi, over the course of this, which he said this: we want peace. Why aren't we concluding a peace agreement immediately? It's because it's very difficult. There were root causes for our president's decision to launch the special military operation. We must reach an agreement that addresses these root causes. And then Peskov went on to identify some of the issues. Does Ukraine intend to seek NATO membership? We are against it because it would pose a threat to our country. Does Ukraine intend to seek the deployment of foreign troops or NATO forces on its territory near our borders? We are against it. There are many, many other issues that need to be resolved during peace talks. So this is a very complex task. First, we must define the framework. So, a framework, negotiations, negotiations primarily between Russia and the United States. The Ukrainians maybe can participate with a negotiating team of their own, but nobody should be in any doubt if negotiations of that kind begin, then the negotiations will be ultimately between the Americans and the Russians. And that is how it should be, because as so many people have pointed out, and as the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has admitted, this is ultimately an American proxy war against Russia. And if a deal is going to be done, it has to be done between the two principal parties, which are Russia and the United States, not Russia and Ukraine. Well, there it is. Now, that's, I suspect, what Witkoff and Kushner are going to encounter in Moscow. In fact, Peskov is clearly here speaking with his master, as his master's voice, as Putin's voice. And to repeat again, Putin has called the Ukrainian government a junta, which clearly implies that regime change in Kiev has to be part of the agenda as well. Now, I will finish this quick rundown, about the situation over Ukraine with two quick further points. Firstly, one of the problems that Zelensky is going to face if he takes charge in Kiev is that, of course, the Americans and the Germans have accused him of being the mastermind of the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. Various Ukrainian special forces officers are now under indictment. One of them is apparently now extradited to Germany. The Russians consider the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines a terrorist act. It's difficult to see the Russians accepting Zelensky as a fit person to conduct negotiations with as well. And one wonders quite why there is this enthusiasm for him in the West and in Britain in particular. And secondly, Ukraine has completely dropped the mask on its attacks on the Russian, on the tankers, the shadow tankers carrying out the oil trade with Russia. They've also conducted an attack on one of the on a tanker, apparently off the African coast. Obviously a complex operation. This is all starting to look a little bit, by the way, like Operation Spider's Web. But exactly as I predicted when I discussed these attacks 2 days ago, this has provoked furious reactions from the government of Kazakhstan, which has denounced what the Ukrainians are doing in the strongest terms. And it has also led to an angry reaction from President Erdogan of Turkey, who has pointed out that some of these attacks have taken place within Turkey's own economic zone. I think that the Ukrainians are showing signs of incredible recklessness, in desperation in doing these things. And I think it will turn out very badly for them. I will try to discuss this all in more detail in my next programme. Now, I mentioned at the start of this programme that I would say something about Venezuela. There are reports that President Trump has given an ultimatum to President Maduro to quit. I'm not sure by which date, by the way. And yesterday there was some kind of council, apparently, of President Trump and his top advisers in the Oval Office. And many people, probably correctly, are seeing this as the start of a council of war. Meanwhile, the Brazilian government is becoming increasingly alarmed about the situation. They've issued statements saying that they do not expect an American attack on Venezuela to take place. But if it does, then Brazil will act negatively and increasingly strongly against that attack. This is a very high-risk game that the administration is playing. By the way, it is also wrong. This is an attack on Venezuela, would, in my opinion, be an attack on a country that is in no way threatening the United States, not even notionally, and not even in terms of its supposed involvement in the drugs trade, which I don't think anybody takes seriously. But it looks as if something like that is now on its way. Well, I will discuss that further, perhaps in the next programme, perhaps after what now looks to me the inevitable American strike takes place. But this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also, by the way, on our Substack, where I also, by the way, am publishing articles. Remember, you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.